This is the last message introducing the core concepts behind our new vision. We long to be a church where Jesus mends broken lives with the goodness of God and equips us to join him in his work. And for that to happen, we need to prayerfully cultivate six values. Well, of course, there are many, many values that we really need, but six of them flow naturally out of a vision statement and kind of fit us. We want to be a church that is firm in biblical standards, yet flexible in ministry style, confident that Jesus is at work, humbly transparent, with respect and compassion for others, delighted in God, passionate for spiritual growth and ministry skill. And the last value, our subject today, is committed to be part of what Christ is doing in the church and in the world. Now, our text is a classic example of this value. It's from Isaiah chapter 6, first 8 verses. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord seated on a throne, high and exalted, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him were seraphs, each with six wings. With two wings they covered their faces, with two they covered their feet, and with two they were flying. And they were calling to one another, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory." At the sound of their voices, the doorposts and thresholds shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. "Woe to me," I cried, "I am ruined. For I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty." Then one of the seraphs flew to me with a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with tongs from the altar. With it he touched my mouth and said, "See, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away, and your sin atoned for." Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send? And who will go for us?" And I said, "Here am I. Send me." Six chapters into his life work, Isaiah includes a flashback of an unforgettable spiritual experience, a day when faith penetrated his heart in a new way, the day when his service or his ministry to God really, really began. He even remembers the date, turning point for Israel, the death of Uzziah. We don't know where Isaiah was physically at the time, but the temple or the tabernacle established the motif of the vision. The temple was the Old Testament architectural model of the gospel. So this is, in a sense, a vision involving the gospel. And central to the vision, as is central to the gospel itself, it was God. Isaiah saw God on the throne that the mercy seat symbolized, and surrounded not by carved angels, but the real thing. In other words, Isaiah, like the Apostle John much later, was swept into heaven in a vision and saw in a vision God's holy being manifested in terms of the temple design. And through this vision, Isaiah stood in God's heavenly sanctuary. I'd like to try to really build this up, but it's just, I don't know how to describe this. It's hard for me to even imagine it. From The Wizard of Oz to The Matrix and others, we see so many special effects in our lives. But I just know, and I'm sure you can appreciate, that standing in the presence of God Almighty is something that we would just be overwhelmed. I can't quite imagine it, let alone describe it. Isaiah saw angels in their natural state, an entirely unique and higher order of being. We're not used to encountering higher orders of being. We're the highest creature on earth, but not in heaven. When people like Daniel or John encountered angels, they just fell on their faces. It was instinctual. That's why it's so important to see that the angels feel the same way about God that we feel about angels. They're covering their eyes, covering themselves up. His glory is so intense. And ringing through the temple is this cry, "Holy, holy, holy." It's God's holiness that's so overwhelming. His utter separation, his complete distinctiveness from anything in the created universe. We reflect God's image in a small way, but no one and nothing is God's equal in all of time and space. He is utterly unbound, defined by his unchanging perfection, but knowing no external limits of any kind. Holiness means that you have no control over God whatsoever. That's why he's fearsome. You can't control him. It's not because he's evil, but you can't control him. You can't overpower him. You can't hurt him. You can't intimidate him. You can't seduce him. He defines what is right, so there's never any argument about how your every act and word and thought will be judged. God defines reality. He made it. The temple shook. Reality bends around his throne. Isaiah's latest purchase, what his dinner plans were, maybe even his next breath, everything is on hold, put aside in the presence of the Holy One. This is hard for us to imagine. In this age of sin, God hides himself. He hides himself so his holiness does not destroy the earth before he can finish his salvation. The true center of the universe is hidden, while each one of us imagines that we are the center of the universe, and all things revolve around us. Only faith can see what the world will see literally one day, that all things revolve around the Creator. All things hold whatever meaning and purpose that He defines. How completely out of place, how completely superfluous Isaiah must have felt, you know, standing there. There's no indication at this point that anybody had taken any notice of him. Have you ever felt completely outclassed? In this imagery of the vision, the angels proclaim God's holiness throughout the earth. It fills the earth. What did Isaiah have to add to that? What was he doing there? What was he doing anywhere? How did his life relate to all this? To all that is significant? Like a star with its energy drained, his soul kind of collapsed. He stood before God, his whole self-made life irrelevant. He wasn't invisible, but he was entirely transparent. His life without substance before the only one whose opinion ultimately matters. This is the moment when Isaiah's faith solidifies. You know, he's a PK. He's a priest kid. He's brought up probably in a godly home. He's talked the talk of religion since childhood. And he's said all the right words. And he's performed all the right rituals. He has accurately described the Lord for years. But standing before his throne, he realizes that all of his fine words did as much to cover God's glory as reveal it. They were so inadequate. He'd had no idea what he'd been talking about. He had no idea what he'd been talking about. He had honored God with his lips, but how close had his heart been to those truths? In the Lord's presence, Isaiah saw the shallowness of his faith, the sorry inadequacy of all Israel's faith. Their history, their rituals, the temple, all of it gave glory to God, but their feeble attempts to give that glory were pathetic, undermined by so much self-will and self-centeredness and such a teeny faith. Isaiah saw on the day, he saw all that on the day that he stood in a vision at the center of the universe. Nobody yelled at Isaiah. Nobody told him his faith was two-dimensional. Nobody had to, because now he saw the living God. Woe to me. I'm ruined. I'm a man of unclean lips. I live among a people of unclean lips. My eyes have seen the King, the Lord of glory. Remember how Job said, you know, I'd heard of you with the hearing of the ear, but now I see you. I just shut my mouth. I think for the first time in his life, Isaiah was truly sorry for pretending the world revolved around him. He saw the stupidity of it. Sorry his life had been so comparatively disconnected from reality all this time. And in response to that true and profound sorrow, an angel was set in motion, a live coal from the altar that indicated the true purifying power of God's sacrifice. See, this has touched your lips. Your guilt's taken away. Your sin's atoned for. Of course, it wasn't the coal. It was the altar and the sacrifice it represented. And Isaiah knew that as a priest kid. It was a magnificent way to communicate to him the power of God's grace. As this angel of compassion reminds him that God's grace is sufficient, sufficient for all of the shallow faith, sufficient for all of Isaiah, sufficient. And as deeply as Isaiah was impressed with God and then with his own sin, he became forever, forever impressed with God's grace. And you hear him preaching it for the next 40 years. And Isaiah realized at that moment in the vision that grace had changed everything. Everything was different. He no longer felt out of place in God's throne. He belonged there. He belonged with God. And for the first time, he hears God speak. And God's not speaking to him in particular. God is talking to himself, using the royal we of the Trinity, as if he could hear God's mind. Whom shall I send? Who will go for us? Who will wrap his life around accomplishing my will? And Isaiah knew, down to his toes, for the first time, why he had been born. Why he stood on 2 feet and breathed air. Why he had hands to do and ears to hear. And why he had lips. Here am I, send me. I chose this text because any serious revisioning of the church, including the one we're exploring, requires that each of us revision our own lives in terms of God's will and his centrality. Jesus taught us to pray for God's will on earth as it is in heaven, or as we phrase it, to join Christ in his work. This is a value we very, very much need to cultivate. We have a long way to go, and it's not natural in this world to wrap one's life around God's will. It's not natural here. It's natural in the heavenlies, where things are normal, but it's not natural here. Not everyone who claims to follow God is like Jesus, and we're afraid of bizarre fanaticism. Or more likely, we just don't feel like life really revolves around God. Doesn't feel that way. Our world ignores him completely or turns him into a religion that can be manipulated by people of power. The center of the universe is hidden. And only faith can see it. Now, like Isaiah coming into this, we have faith, but faith always starts out small, like a mustard seed, and it can barely see God. It's like looking through a clouded glass. And so we try to do God's will. We try to serve him. We really do, as far as our faith allows, as far as that, as what we see through that clouded glass inspires us. And the Lord is genuinely appreciative of all the service that we offer to him, and he always honors those who honor him. But we can only do that, we can only try as hard as our vision of him is clear. And you know what? I just don't think that we serve God as much as we might think we do. I would like to correct what I believe is a widespread misunderstanding. A lot of people confuse a principle with a fact. That is to say, I often hear Christians saying something like this: Christians served Jesus everywhere, or Christians can serve Jesus everywhere, and that's what we're doing, not just within the walls of the church, but we can serve Christ in our careers, in our families, in our business, in our government. Which is true, but it's said as if we were doing that. But saying it doesn't make it happen and doesn't mean that we actually are serving him. How much do we really devote our lives to accomplishing God's will? Think about what it would mean to work with God to accomplish his will. Think of it as if it were the only thing that ultimately mattered. And the reason I would ask such a silly question is because doing God's will is the only thing that ultimately matters. And it's a hard question to answer. I struggle with it. And the fact that I struggle with it tells you something about how well I'm doing myself. Just try to imagine how you would live if you could clearly see God at the center of the universe. It's more than just going through life. Surely working with him to accomplish his will must involve more than just showing up for work, or having and raising a family, or participating in community and in government. Lots of people with no sense of God do all that. What would it mean to truly work with God on your job? Just this week, I heard of a conversation one of our members had with a coworker. She works in the government, and she was discussing a difficult issue, and she decided to take a break both of them to think about what was said. She was talking to somebody, and she said, yes, and I need to pray about this also. And her colleague was surprised. You pray about these things? You pray about your job? And what intrigued me when I heard the story was that her colleague is a confessing Christian who just never imagined to pray about work stuff. Well, I'm not just talking about praying for God to help you succeed at work. Of course, doing his will at work includes doing your work well. But what else is God interested in? He's interested in so much more. For example, the Lord is interested not only in your personal success at work, but that your job contributes something of value to human society. Whether it's a widget or whether it's a service, you can make the world a better place. And doing that reflects his design that one day will be reinstituted and become the norm here. And you glorify God by making this world a better place. You glorify him. So it's not just a matter of your being successful. What can you do to improve your job, your industry, your profession? My profession is a pastor. Not only should I desire and do desire to be a good pastor, I want to lift up the pastorate, what a pastor is. I want to make the church a better place. What about you? If you were to pray about that for 4 or 5 years, do you think God would give you any ideas about how to improve your industry, what you do? What if every Christian did that? How many of us are there? What if every Christian spent 4 or 5 years asking God how to make what they do something better, more productive? Not only that, but God is working in the lives of every single person that you work with. And he would work with you to bring his grace to any number of them. And you don't even have to take the initiative. Just respond with grace when you see a need. God knows exactly how he would like to bless each one if you're available to work with him. He may judge them one day, but today he wants to bless them. And you are there. You see them every day. He would like to work with you. Working with God to manifest his grace in the lives of even 2 of your coworkers over 30 years might equal in significance everything else you do in your entire career. How much is a soul worth? No matter how important you might feel your job is in and of itself, God did not put you there just so that you could do a good job. He put you next to people whose lives need mending. You can bring Jesus into the workplace. You don't turn into a church. You just bring Jesus into the workplace with you. Let him mend lives with you. What would it mean? What would it mean to truly work with God in your home? Whew. Let me take this from a different angle. What if you had an exchange student coming from overseas who was going to live with you for 6 months? What if you had an exchange student who's going to come live with you for 6 months, and when he arrives, he gets to know you, becomes aware of your faith, he approaches you with a smile, and he says, I prayed to God to send me to a Christian home. I have no Christian influences where I come from. I came to Christ through an old aunt who's now died. Would you disciple me while I'm in your home? Would you do that? Wouldn't that be exciting? What would you do? You have 6 months. You have 6 months to train a willing young mind and heart and then send them out into that world that needs Christ. A person no missionary was going to reach, you could reach, and who knows what ultimate impact. What would you do? Well, I guess you'd drive him to church. And that would be excellent because he needs church. But I seriously doubt that's all you'd do if he asked you to disciple him. I bet you'd be overwhelmed at first thinking about how could I do this? But you'd figure something out. I bet you'd get him reading the Bible. I bet you have him reading the Bible. And you'd study it together. How much? I don't know. An hour a week? Would that be enough for discipleship? Maybe you'd use a prepared study somebody's written or just talk about what he read. I bet you'd pray for him. And I bet you would pray with him because he wants to know how to pray. Now, that could be difficult because maybe you never learned how to pray. Maybe you never learned how to pray out loud. But here he's asking you, would you teach me how to pray? You know what you'd do? you'd learn. You'd learn, and you would teach. You'd teach him how to pray. Okay? You'd discuss life with him. You would relate the Christian faith to it every chance you got. You'd develop your own plan, but it would be a good one because you know after he leaves, that may be all the training he'll ever get. What a privilege. So tell me, why are so very few Christian parents doing these things for their own kids? If they knew, if they understood, they would come to you and say, please, disciple me. We drive them to church. That's good. That's great. Are they reading the scriptures? Are you discussing the scriptures with them every week? Are you teaching them how to pray? Oh, I never learned how to pray. You could learn to teach them how to relate God to life. What about all those conversations about God's will? You know, so many children in Christian homes never even get 6 months of real discipleship before they leave home with all the training they may ever get. I could ask the same questions about working with God in the church. What does it mean to work in the church? Why do people keep saying 20% of the congregation does 80% of the work? What would it look like if everyone, including the pastor, bent their lives around God and was determined to build a church that glorified him? What would it look like? We long to be a church where Jesus mends broken lives with the goodness of God and equips us to join him in his work. Becoming that kind of church requires a commitment to be part of what Christ is doing in the church and in the world. How do we develop this value? How do we become committed? Well, I can tell you something from this text. Isaiah didn't get there through guilt. The priest didn't browbeat him, or if it did, it didn't work. Didn't shame him, didn't tell him he better shape up. Wouldn't do me any good to try to do that. Guilt never works as a motivator for Christians. We're the only ones who don't have any guilt. Doesn't work. Isaiah didn't get there by simply picking up another task, as if you know, he's got his life here, and now God wants me to serve him, so I'm going to add one more thing to my to-do list, and that'll be serving God. Did you notice that Isaiah did not volunteer for anything specific? Did you notice that? In the throne room of God, after discovering a deeper faith than he'd ever had before, Isaiah heard the Lord talking to himself, "Whom shall I send? Who will go for us?" And Isaiah said, "Hey, I'm here. I'll go. Where? When? How? To do what?" He didn't know. God's servants are never called just to a task or a role. Of course, God knows where our service is going to go. He has prepared good works beforehand, and our service will become and mature into a calling in time. But service to God is never rooted in a commitment to a particular task. Working with God begins with an offering of oneself to God to do whatever he wants, wherever he wants, however he wants. We volunteer to him. We commit ourselves to working for his agenda, his desires, his dreams, because we cannot imagine anything better to do with our lives. No matter what we're doing, no matter what our livelihoods may be, can't imagine anything better to do with life than to serve you. That's not volunteering for a task or a project. It's ennobling my entire life by dedicating myself to serve him as a lifestyle. It becomes who I am. Here I am. Send me wherever, whatever, however. Serving you, it's what I do. Isaiah became seriously committed to be part of what God is doing in the church and in the world on the day he gained a clear vision of God. In the gospel, pure, perfect, holy, gracious, a vision of holiness that put him face to face with the shallowness of his faith, faith that was then widened and deepened by God's transcendent grace, grace that left him standing free and joyful in God's presence, so close he could hear God talking to himself and sense God's passion and plan for his people in the world. And from that day on, Isaiah was a sent man. Wherever God led, wherever God equipped, he would serve the Lord's interests and labor to accomplish his will. And that's how you and I could become God's servants too. Won't happen through guilt, won't happen through force of will, won't happen by some token extra involvement. We become God's servants on the blessed day that we see the Lord high and lifted up with his train filling the temple. I can't give that vision to you. You can't create it for yourself. Only God can reveal himself to you. And he will. If you seek him, he will. He promised that. He said, you will call upon me and come and pray to me and I will listen to you. You will seek me and you will find me when you seek me with all your heart. Oh, I'm not sure I know how to seek God. Look, he just told you, seek him with all your heart. Do whatever you know to do and keep doing it until you learn something better. With all your heart to seek him. Be aware, you've seen it in the text, finding God is always bittersweet. It's bitter when you come face to face with the shallowness of your faith, how glibly you've taken it all for granted, how much of your life you have wasted, and how much sin still clings so closely. But oh, how sweet when the finished work of Christ hits home hard and you realize nothing can separate you from him and you belong there. You belong there right by God's side. What Isaiah experienced in a dramatic vision might happen to you dramatically. Or it may be more like a tipping point that creeps up on you gradually and unexpected, a slowly growing awareness of God's greatness. And then at some point, quiet reflection, singing a song, coming to the table, passionately explaining to the conservation club how God feels about the earth, teaching your child how he or she was born to glorify God. Slowly growing awareness of God's greatness that at some point tips over, overwhelms you. When you see it, when you really see God's holy greatness, it makes you cry. He's so good. Life could be so good. This world is so sadly ruined, and I'm so sadly ruined. But he has touched my life and he has made me part of the solution with him. That's when you find yourself so close to God, you can hear him. You can hear him talking to himself. It's not that you're going to hear anything you don't already know. It's all in the scripture. But you're going to receive it with ears that can hear the sweep of God's plan. All he wants to do in the church and in the world. His desire to bring it all to pass alongside of his children. You'll know why you were born. You'll know why you have hands and feet and lips. We have a new vision for ministry. But the only thing that will bring that vision into reality is if we first gain a proper vision of God and be overwhelmed by the gospel so that we are absolutely committed to be part of what Christ is doing in the church and in the world.